Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Litigation Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, March 1st, 2018, during a live teleform conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's teleform conference call, as today we preview the Lucia versus SEC, an important case examining the use of agency administrative law judges and separation of powers and the appointments clause. I'm Dean Reuter, General Counsel and Vice President, Director of Practice Groups here at the Federal Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast and will likely be transcribed as well. We welcome back return guest to Teleform, Shane Kelly. He's an associate at the Wiley Ryan Law Firm right here in Washington, D.C. He's going to begin with an introduction and overview and some discussion of prior appointments clause cases. Ultimately, we'll be looking to the audience for questions, so please have those in mind for when we get to that portion of the program. But with these first thoughts, let's turn it over now to Shane Kelly.
All right. Thank you, Dean. And as he mentioned, I'm an attorney at Wiley Ryan in Washington, D.C., and I work in the White Collar Defense and Government Investigations Practice Group. And today I'm going to be discussing Lucia v. Securities and Exchange Commission for the Supreme Court and providing background on the issues and some implications of the decision. So briefly, the issue is whether the SEC's administrative law judges were appointed in a manner that violated the Constitution. And the case is very important because the scope of the decision could actually affect a wide variety of administrative officials at other agencies and potentially call into question the structure of a lot of federal agencies. And so although the SEC is involved in this case here, the case really has implications broadly for the federal government. So today I'm just going to cover some background on the constitutional provision at issue in this case, which is the Appointments Clause, and then we'll talk about the SEC's structure and the litigation about whether or not its ALJs violated the Appointments Clause. And finally, we'll talk more about the case before the Supreme Court. So just by way of background, the constitutional provision at issue in this case is the Appointments Clause, which is Article 2, Section 2, Clause 2 of the U.S. Constitution. And it states, he, the president, shall nominate and by and with the advice and consent of the Senate, shall appoint ambassadors and other public ministers and consuls, judges of the Supreme Court, and all other officers of the United States whose appointments are not herein otherwise provided for and which shall be established by law. But the Congress may by law vest the appointment of such inferior officers as they think proper in the president alone, in the courts of law, or in the heads of departments. And so that last in the courts of law or in the heads of departments. And so this clause defines the powers of the president to appoint government officials and the limits on that power. And it essentially creates three classes of government employees. First, there are principal officers, which are discussed in the first part of the appointments clause. The word principal doesn't appear in the language, but that's the term used. And, you know, this would be, you know, high cabinet level officials like, you know, the attorney general. So that's a principal officer, and they can only be appointed with the advice and consent of the Senate. Then the second category is inferior officers. So Congress can by law vest appointment power of inferior officers in three places: the president alone, the courts of law, or the heads of departments. And the Supreme Court has interpreted the phrase heads of departments to mean basically agencies and departments in the executive branch that exercise authority under the president. So any top-level official of a cabinet-level department or a similar executive agency could receive appointment power to appoint, you know, inferior officers, although the boundaries of that haven't fully been defined. But that's the general idea. So there are a couple of implications from that structure. First, any inferior officer that is not appointed by one of those three entities would not be basically a duly appointed government official under the Constitution, and so their actions would not be authorized in a proper manner by the government. And then the second important implication is that Congress's role is limited to advice and consent of principal officers, and they cannot delegate to themselves appointment power of inferior officers. And so it says in the Heritage Guide to the Constitution that one of the key worries of the framers was that Congress would try to kind of take over the appointment power for itself. And if you have the authority to both create a position, as Congress does, you know, create an office and then fund it, And also appoint that position, then you have kind of unchecked power to create government officials with authority. And so the idea here was that Congress itself cannot be a part of the appointment process other than in the specific ways that are defined here. And so there are principal officers, inferior officers, and then the final category is basically ordinary government employees. So these are, you know, this is the vast majority of people that work for the federal government who are not principal officers, they're not inferior officers, and they don't have to be hired in accordance with the Appointments Clause. So importantly, the Constitution says absolutely nothing about the boundary between a principal and inferior officer or about the boundary between an inferior officer and a mere employee. So there's no constitutional language to parse in determining whether or not a particular office or person should follow one route under the Appointments Clause or can follow another. So this just leaves it ambiguous as to what is constitutionally necessary in a specific case. And because there's no clear definition, the Supreme Court has generally taken a case-by-case approach to these issues. It's not created one specific test that determines whether a position is a principal officer, inferior officer, or just an employee. But the cases have created, you know, guideposts, as they often do, about what, you know, what type of a position should fall in under each category. So the first case I'm going to talk about, just to give some background on how the court has looked at these issues before, is Buckley v. Valeo. And there the court reviewed the powers of the Federal Election Commission under the Federal Election Campaign Act. And under the law, as it was passed by Congress, the FEC was made up of 8 members. This is the Federal Election Commission as it was in the 70s, immediately after the Watergate scandal, so it looks very different from the FEC now. And at that time, Congress passed the Federal Election Campaign Act, created the FEC, and they gave power to appoint some of the members to Congress itself. So certain members of Congress could appoint members of the Federal Election Commission. And one of the questions the court reviewed in this case was whether or not the members of the FEC, as it was constituted at that time, were in fact inferior officers under the Constitution. And if they were inferior officers, then Congress could not vest appointment power in itself. So the Supreme Court held that that the appointees of the Federal Election Commission were officers of the United States and were not mere employees because they, quote, exercised significant authority pursuant to the laws of the United States. And because they had, you know, significant authority exercised pursuant to a public law, they were officers and they weren't just employees. And the court said that employees are, quote, lesser functionaries subordinate to officers of the United States. And the court found that these members were inferior officers because they had substantial discretionary authority to administer the federal election regime without supervision by any other officer of the United States. So in discussing what powers the FEC could wield given its structure, the court said that, you know, if it just has employees, they could investigate and disseminate information. So they can receive reports about, you know, federal election campaigns and they can give out that information. However, it said, you know, if without, you cannot enforce laws using discretionary authority if you're just an employee. You can't seek judicial relief and you can't conduct civil litigation. The court also found that rulemaking and regulatory authority was too important to be administered by just employees. So because the FEC at that time had that authority, you know, its members could not be just employees. So that case gives, you know, some kind of general test. It's obviously quite vague that, you know, what is significant authority pursuant to the laws of the United States and what does it mean to be a lesser functionary subordinate to the officers of the United States. But it gives some guidance. So the next case I'm going to talk about is Morrison v. Olson. So there the court reviewed the constitutionality of the independent counsel provisions of the Ethics in Government Act passed after Watergate. And under that regime, the special division, which was a special court created by the Ethics in Government Act, could appoint an independent counsel to investigate wrongdoing. And in this case, an independent counsel was appointed to investigate Ted Olson, and it's the Ted Olson who's more well-known now. And he argued as a part of that investigation that the way the independent counsel had been appointed was unconstitutional on a variety of grounds. The Supreme Court ultimately found that the independent counsel was an inferior officer, so not an employee, nor was it a principal officer. And for that reason, Congress could validly vest the appointment power in the special division, which was a court. And the court said that there were multiple factors that made the independent counsel an inferior officer instead of a principal officer. So one, the independent counsel was subject to removal by a more senior official, in this case, the attorney general. The independent counsel only had limited defined duties. You know, the investigation and prosecution of federal crimes in a very specific case, you know, it's similar to the special counsel investigation currently, although it was a different regime, but, you know, they would be appointed to investigate a specific instance. They didn't have law enforcement authority ongoing forever. And their jurisdiction was defined by the special division. So the special court defined the jurisdiction of this position. And the office was also limited in tenure, so once the mandate was carried out, the office ceased to exist. And so despite the substantial, you know, law enforcement discretionary authority of the independent counsel, which the court said was enough to make them, you know, some kind of officer of the United States, the court ultimately found they were just inferior officers because of all the limitations on their authority. So the final case I'm going to discuss today, just as background, is Freytag v. Commissioner of Internal Revenue. And there, the Supreme Court found that a special trial judge in the United States Tax Court was an inferior officer, and therefore the selection needed to comply with the Appointments Clause. In this case, the special trial judges were appointed by the chief judge of the tax court, and they had ability to kind of conduct tax litigation, but they were not able to render final opinions of the tax court, and they basically had the chief judge of the tax court that would review their findings and propose opinions, but at the same time they had independent authority to conduct litigation. So the court found that type of structure, it makes them an inferior officer. And I'm just going to read a quote from the case because it really neatly ties together all the different facts that the court found there made the special trial judges to be inferior officers. So they said, quote, "The commissioner reasons that special trial judges may be deemed employees because they lack authority to enter a final decision. But this argument ignores the significance of the duties and discretion that special trial judges possess. The office of special trial judge is, quote, established by law, and the duties, salaries, and means of appointment for that office are specified by statute. These characteristics distinguish special trial judges from special masters who are hired by Article III courts on a temporary, episodic basis, whose positions are not established by law, and whose duties and functions are not delineated in statute. Furthermore, special trial judges perform more than ministerial tasks. They take testimony, conduct trials, rule on the admissibility of evidence, and have the power to enforce compliance with discovery orders. In the course of carrying out these important functions, the special trial judges exercise significant discretion. And the court went on then to determine if the manner of selection for the special trial judges complied with the Appointments Clause, and saying that it did because the tax court was a court of law. And so as you can see from, you know, looking at the language of these cases, the key question in this inquiry is really how much authority and how independent is a particular federal employee, and, you know, do they have so much power that they have to be appointed, and if they're officers of the United States, you know, was their appointment in accordance with the Appointment Clause of the Constitution? And that kind of concludes my opening remarks and just background.
Terrific. Let me do two things now. Actually, I'm going to open the floor to questions so people can begin to queue up, but I also want to ask you if you would next talk about background on this particular case, talk about what's at stake, and how the three cases you mentioned, Buckley, Morrison, and Freytag, apply in the current circumstance. But first, let's open the floor to questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button anytime along the way. And Shane Kelly, in the meantime, if you could walk us through this case and how these previous cases in the law might be applied here.
Yeah, absolutely. So with regard to this specific case, Lucia is really about the boundary between an employee and an inferior officer in the context of the SEC. So the question is whether or not the SEC's administrative law judges should be considered mere employees, or if they're inferior officers. And if it's the latter, if they're inferior officers, then they can only be selected in accordance with the Appointments Clause. And the SEC and its administrative law judges are structured kind of as follows. So the SEC is composed of five commissioners that are appointed by the president with the advice and consent of the Senate. But to allow for greater efficiency, Congress has passed laws that give it authority to delegate matters to administrative law judges, sometimes called hearing officers. And historically, ALJs were not selected by the full commission. They were selected bureaucratically. The SEC staff would select from a pool of candidates identified by the Office of Personnel Management. So the commission, like the SEC, has authority to bring a civil suit in federal court against violators of securities laws, but it can also institute a civil administrative action, and that's where the ALJs come in. They conduct administrative hearings, and they can administer oaths and issue subpoenas and examine witnesses and rule on motions, enter orders of default, and they also have a very limited amount of contempt power, so they can exclude people from hearings if they're being disruptive or, you know, not obeying court orders. However, ALJs cannot seek court enforcement of a subpoena, and they have no authority to punish disobedience with discovery orders or fine or imprison people for contempt. So they have much more limited power than, say, a federal district court judge. And the full commission can review decisions of ALJs on its own initiative or on petition of a party. And for certain categories of actions, review by the full commission is mandatory. But if the full commission chooses not to review an ALJ action in a specific case within a specified time period, then it's deemed to be an action of the full commission, and an order is issued that puts the ALJ's initial decision into effect. So basically, there's a kind of automatic effectiveness or enforcement of ALJ decisions unless the commission seeks to review, and about 90% of ALJ decisions are never reviewed by the full commission, so the vast majority of ALJ decisions just kind of go into effect. So in this specific case, Lucia, an ALJ found that Raymond Lucia had violated provisions of the Investment Advisors Act for ways that they presented a wealth management strategy to potential customers called buckets of money. And so Lucia raised the argument that the ALJ that decided the case was an inferior officer and had not been appointed in a manner consistent with the Appointments Clause. And this argument was raised to the full commission at the SEC, and they rejected the argument, no big surprise. And Lucia appealed and sought review from the D.C. Circuit. So the D.C. Circuit found in a unanimous opinion that the ALJs were not officers at all under the Constitution. They were just employees. And so they did not need to be chosen in the manner described in the Appointments Clause. And because of prior D.C. Circuit precedent, the court focused on whether or not SEC ALJ decisions were final, and they found that they were not really issuing final decisions given the structure of further review by the full commission. So because, you know, Lucia lost before the D.C. Circuit filed for a rehearing en banc, but in the meantime, a different circuit court, the Tenth Circuit, reached basically the opposite result from the D.C. Circuit in a case called Bandemir v. SEC. And so in this other case, somebody else argued that the SEC's ALJs were not constitutionally appointed, and the Tenth Circuit actually agreed with that argument, finding that they were inferior officers and that they had been unconstitutionally appointed. But it was not a unanimous panel. So the panel opinion was 2-1. And the court there focused on really the trial judge, the special trial judges in Freytag, founding that the ALJs wielded very similar authority to the special trial judges there. And because the appointment was not by the full commission of the SEC's ALJs, you know, a head of a department had not appointed the ALJs, and it violated the Appointments Clause. And so on those grounds, the Tenth Circuit set aside the SEC's opinion in that case. However, it was not a united opinion. Judge McKay issued a really strong dissent, disagreeing with the majority's reasoning, but also warning that this decision had huge ramifications for ALJs and other administrative agencies, because the SEC's structure of authority for its ALJs is by no means unique. And so Judge McKay feared that this decision to invalidate the SEC's ALJs really called into question a lot of different government entities. So that was, you know, after the filing for rehearing en banc, the Tenth Circuit came out creating a circuit split. And then the full D.C. Circuit actually granted en banc review, but then deadlocked on the decision. So they split 5-5 as to whether they should reverse the panel's opinion. And so they issued no opinion because they were deadlocked and couldn't come to a decision. So basically where the case ended up is there was a very clear circuit split on a binary question. So, you know, are ALJs employees or are they inferior officers? There's no middle ground there. It has to be yes or no. And there was a direct circuit split on it. And because this is really a constitutional question about separation of powers, and it also has a lot of practical effect for, you know, a major government agency, all of that made Supreme Court review pretty likely. So the court ended up granting certiorari in Lucia, and so that's how the case got there. There was a kind of interesting wrinkle in the certiorari process, though, that's worth discussing. So the government, the federal government, actually switched sides in this case. So the SEC and the federal government took the position before the D.C. Circuit that the ALJs were just employees, and therefore the process was constitutional. However, in the certiorari process, the Solicitor General filed a brief saying, you know, we agree now that the ALJs are inferior officers, despite the fact that the SEC had actually won below. They asked the court to take the case, saying that it had been wrongly decided. And then something else kind of strange happened. So the day after the Solicitor General filed their brief, basically conceding the unconstitutionality of the ALJ appointments, on November 30th, 2017, the full commission of the SEC, quote, ratified the appointment of the existing ALJs. It's essentially trying to make them prospectively constitutional by affirming their position. So presumably the full commission would be ahead of a department. And so, if the full commission chooses them, then they're constitutional. And so what they tried to do is basically they issued a press release saying, we have ratified the appointment of these people, trying to limit the fallout of, you know, the new position of the government. But it's very unclear whether or not this action would really be sufficient to save them going forward. Lucia has argued in its briefing before the Supreme Court that this doesn't really solve the problem because the hiring process was unconstitutional and you can't just, you know, reinvent what actually happened, post hoc, and that, you know, the ratification process here had none of the procedures that a normal appointment does. And so the irregularities, Lucia is saying, you know, this ratification means nothing. The SEC is trying to limit potential fallout by saying, you know, all our ALJs now are fully valid. And the commission also directed the ALJs to review all of their open cases to see if they want to ratify their prior decisions. So basically inviting them to go through and say, yep, we agree with everything we've done, to try and, again, limit the fallout in case the court finds that they were appointed unconstitutionally. So that brings us up to, you know, merits briefing. You know, initial merits briefs have been filed. And the argument is now set for April 23rd, 2018. But because the SEC and Lucia are now on the same side of the constitutional issue, you basically both agree that the ALJs are inferior officers, the court appointed somebody else to argue the position in defense of the D.C. Circuit's opinion that the SEC's ALJs are not inferior officers and are just employees. So the court appointed Anton Metlitsky from O'Melveny in New York to brief and argue that issue. His brief isn't due until the end of March, so we don't yet know what his focus will be. But it's fairly easy to guess what the fault lines will be in terms of the briefing. You know, one side will be arguing that the ALJs do not exercise significant authority and are really just employees, while the other side, you know, in this case, which will be Lucia and the Solicitor General, will be arguing that the ALJs, you know, do exercise significant authority and are inferior officers. And it's not a clear issue because there really are mixed factual indicators here. You know, in some ways they have a lot of authority and discretion, but in other ways their activities are pretty constrained and controlled by the full commission. So, you know, whether or not it falls, you know, which side of the line it falls on, you know, is really what the court has to decide. And the most important precedent here will be Freytag. So because the court there found that the special trial judges from the tax court were inferior officers, and in many ways the ALJs are pretty similar to them, they both have authority to kind of generally conduct, you know, these adjudicated proceedings. But the ALJ's authority is a little more constrained over litigants, so they don't have full contempt power and they can't compel discovery, which the special trial judges could there. So it's whether or not that's enough to push over the line is unclear. So if the court finds that the SEC's ALJs were inferior officers, then at least until November 30th, 2017, every single decision by the SEC's ALJs would be called into question because none of them were appointed in a manner that complied with the Constitution. And it's hard to know, as it always is, how the court will ultimately come down on this. Because it's not a traditionally ideological case, voting patterns may not fall along, conservative or liberal lines. However, as kind of a more philosophical matter, conservatives are probably more likely to be skeptical of, the Leviathan of the modern administrative state, and so they may are more likely to see that political accountability is, an important component of restraining administrative agencies like the SEC, and so they would want to find the SEC's ALJs unconstitutional because they are essentially insulated from a politically appointed authority. And that's really the heart of the issue here is we want people who are exercising significant government authority to be politically accountable. And if they're not being selected by, a politically accountable authority such as the president, then they're not accountable to anyone. So that's the real issue here. And so conservatives are probably more likely to be skeptical, but again, it's because it's not a clearly ideological case. It's hard to say how it'll come out. But the real question, which will probably be the most interesting and maybe difficult part of the case, will be what remedy could be given in this situation. And if the court finds that the SEC's ALJs were inferior officers, does that mean that every single decision by them is completely invalid? And counsel for Lucia has argued in the merits briefing that the only possible remedy here is to set aside the prior findings in every case and have a complete rehearing before a constitutionally appointed ALJ. So they want a complete rehearing of everything. And they cited, strings of cases saying that a defect in an adjudicator, such as a biased trial judge, just automatically requires a rehearing. There's no other way to remedy the situation. But the problem is if you apply that to every single case that has been before the SEC's ALJs, it would, it'd just be kind of impossible. It would just create a massive backlog. You'd have to, retry years of cases, which would disrupt the ability to enforce the law now and just really disrupt the function of the SEC. There's also a question of whether parties could try to challenge previously closed cases. If a company has recently, last year gave $50 million over to the SEC in a fine, could they now file a suit saying that had been wrongly taken from them? So the potential to just open the floodgates to lots of challenges and lots of complicated litigation is very real. The question is bigger than the SEC as well, because depending on how the opinion is written, it could call into question many more ALJs of other agencies. And so the approach to what an appropriate remedy is here could really cascade through other agencies. So, what they decide here may end up applying to the Department of Homeland Security or, a bunch of other entities. So they really have to be very thoughtful about how they approach that. One option that has some precedent would be to treat basically all prior actions of the ALJs as still binding and valid, but nevertheless require the appointment process to change going forward. So in Buckley v. Valeo, the court did something pretty interesting with regard to the remedy or the effect of their decision with the FEC or Federal Election Commission. So they basically said that all prior actions of the FEC would still be considered valid, and they also stayed the effect of their opinion for 30 days when it was issued so that Congress could reconfigure the structure of the FEC. And instead of just invalidating everything, they basically said it was all the prior actions were valid but required to change prospectively. And they drew an analogy to the apportionment case law before the court where acts of legislators are considered binding even if the election map is later found to be unconstitutional. If an election map is unconstitutional, you don't just wipe away an entire legislative season because that would be kind of unworkable. You basically consider those acts to have had de facto legitimacy at the time, and all prior acts are treated as effective, but you still require change going forward. And so if the court does, indicate that the the SEC's ALJs were unconstitutional, they may, you know, give a very, very weak remedy for people like Lucia who are looking to get a total rehearing and just say everything is valid, but they have to change going forward. And so that's really everything I have for my presentation. I look forward to questions. Just some concluding thoughts. You know, this is a very important case just because of how it could affect the operation of, you know, so many different federal agencies. And while it's really nominally about the SEC, it's really a constitutional separation of powers case, and which is why it's so interesting. And, you know, the decision here, both how they describe the merits and what line they draw and the possible remedy just has a huge implications for the rest of the executive branch. And if they find that the ALJs were, in fact, inferior officers, the real kind of interesting part will be figuring out what in the heck to do about it because it's such a disruptive thing to decide. So I look forward to questions, and that's all I have.
Very good. Thank you so much. We've already opened the floor for questions. If you joined the call late, the floor is open. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open at this point. Nobody's queued up. So let me see if I can get us started here with a question or two. And that is, how much does it matter whether or not these are final decisions, and how is that assessed? In some cases, the SEC has a much higher win rate in front of an ALJ than it does in mm-hmm. federal court. And these decisions ultimately, I suppose, are appealable to, or you can take them to a district court. Mm-hmm. But at that point, presumably the court begins its analysis with deference to the agency decision, to the ALJ's decision, to the SEC decision. So it's not necessarily a final decision, but it's not easily surmountable. Does that matter at all?
Yeah, absolutely. So it would be so a challenge to an ALJ decision is an APA appeal. So, you know, you have the substantial evidence and abuse of discretion standards. But really the issue is, you know, do they have authority to create, you know, binding government orders, you know, without close supervision, I think is kind of how you might describe it. Because if they look more like a district court judge that can issue an order that nobody else can look at right away, you know, it could be appealed, but at the same time they have the power to bind parties with the power of law, then there needs to be some kind of review of a quote officer of the United States, or otherwise, you know, they're exercising what looks like, you know, appointment power. But at the same time, if you know, they're definitely not a rubber stamp, if it's just the first stop in a, you know, meaningful review by another officer of the United States, then the court would be more likely to say they are just, you know, they're just employees assisting the commission. Here the facts are really so mixed, it's very hard again, because the, you know, conceivably the commission could decide to review every single ALJ decision on the merits, and then and therefore, you know, the ALJs would not be exercising much power. You know, so they have the ability to do that, but practically they don't review very many cases. And so it looks a lot like you have, you know, the ALJs binding parties and, you know, making determinations of liability that can be challenged, but in the first instance are have the force of law against the parties. So I think you're absolutely right. You know, it's a difficult issue to parse out, and how you look at it really depends on what you're looking for. You know, if just theoretical ability to review is sufficient, then, you know, here the ALJs do not have, you know, binding authority. But if you look at it kind of practically and in operation, it looks like they're operating pretty independently. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
Well, another example of the practical versus the maybe de jure versus de facto is the ALJ at the Federal Trade Commission. I understand from Josh Wright, he's a former commissioner there, that there's just one ALJ at the Federal Trade Commission. And in over the past so a long period of time, the regulated community has about a 50-50 chance of winning in front of the ALJ. And those decisions then can go to the full commission. But after that, in 100% of the cases where the regulated community prevailed in front of the ALJ, the FTC reverses. And in 100% of the cases where the ALJ has found for the commission affirms. So those are some interesting facts that make for interesting applications.
Have a one-way review.
Right.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. And so with the SEC, there are 5 administrative law judges, which is essentially the same number as commissioners of the SEC. And so it's not like a big army of subordinates. It's like a pretty confined group that has, you know, a fair amount of authority. And as you mentioned, the SEC often for strategic reasons may choose to go with their ALJs as opposed to district court litigation. This case has disrupted their ability to do that because they've been avoiding sending cases to their ALJs because of all the uncertainty. It's a very small group that has a fair amount of power over, you know, the regulated community here. And so that's another worry, you know, if you're looking at this the situation and you don't feel like the full commission is giving a close enough review that, you know, maybe these people should be considered officers.
We do have one question in the audience. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Before we go to that question, let me ask just one quick follow-up question. You mentioned the U.S. Solicitor General switched sides in this case, now says that the administrative law judge is an inferior officer and therefore the appointment is unconstitutional. You've also talked about the remedy in this case. Does the Solicitor General's brief touch on or recommend a remedy given its position?
Yeah, I believe it does not, but let me pull it up really quickly. I believe they didn't.
And how much? Maybe this is a more general question. How much should the court pay attention to the impact of a remedy? If there's been a constitutional violation, and if it goes back, you know, 30, 40, 50 years, is it really their business in doing that sort of legal analysis to consider the consequences of deciding the case one way or the other?
Yeah, absolutely. It could be. So it's not a direct question before the court in the sense that it wasn't part of the question presented. It's just whether or not they're inferior officers. And so it's conceivable that they will, you know, make a finding that they are inferior officers and then, you know, remand or just set aside the opinion but not make any decision about what to do more broadly. I think, you know, in normal cases, you know, there's always a balance of, you know, how pragmatic does the court need to be versus how principled. I think in this case, because the pragmatic considerations are really so vast, I think they have to at least think about it and probably do something because the ability to disrupt so much of the government's operation is there. I think it would be a little bit irresponsible almost to just kind of issue an erudite opinion about this very specific question while not deciding more broadly. The SEC's opinion really did not have a significant amount, aside just looking at it briefly, did not have much about remedies. They do talk about it a little bit. So there was another issue I didn't discuss that the SEC or the Solicitor General put in their brief, which was a removal power. So the ALJs can only be removed for cause, and similarly, the SEC commissioners can only be removed for cause. So to the extent they are not employees but are in fact appointed or officers that should be appointed under the Appointments Clause, there would be basically kind of double removal protection, like a double layer of removal protection. And the SEC brought up that issue in their brief, basically saying that that may be called into question as well, depending on what the courts decide about that. And you know, recent cases talking about removal for cause and the limitations on the president's discretion could apply here. So the SEC argued in their brief that the the question presented really fairly encompasses the removal power one. It wasn't addressed by the D.C. Circuit, or it wasn't addressed by Lucia, but they're basically saying, we want you to look at this too, potentially to just kind of clear this up so that there's not another challenge in the near future. And and the SEC basically said the appropriate remedy here will really depend on whether or not the court concludes that the ALJs, had improper removal power as well. So if this entire class of people was improperly protected, then that's another reason to call it into question. So,
right. Echoing back to the Peekaboo case. Let's take questions from the audience now. We have just one question. If you'd like to join the queue, as I mentioned, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. For now, let's take our first call of the day.
Yeah, hey, thanks for that recitation of the case. I was going to ask you, is this going to have, because it seems so vast what they could do, is this going to have any impact on...
Yeah, I think they absolutely could impact positions like immigration judges. And really, the fear is that this impact or this case. How they write the opinion, they could say basically anybody similar to this is an inferior officer, or they could rule extremely narrowly and say, because of these very particular facts that don't apply to most ALJs, they are inferior officers. So it really depends on the breadth of what they're going to do. In terms of what I would predict, I think it's probably more likely that they're going to find them to be inferior officers, in part because the United States switched positions. So the SEC has had really a bad track record in recent years before the court. They've basically lost 9-0 on a number of cases. And so it could be that they believe they were going to lose again, and by switching positions they could maybe influence how the case comes out a little more, as opposed to just kind of rejecting what the inevitable. So I think maybe it's a little more likely. Normally when the court grants certiorari, there's a greater chance that the court will reverse than affirm. I think about 60% of cases the court reverses.
Wow.
The cases they grant cert on. Here I don't think that's quite as meaningful, because they had a direct kind of one-to-one circuit split. They were more or less kind of obligated to take one of the cases just to clear up the issue, because it had a lot of significance. So I don't know that really means much, although it does in a lot of cases. But here I think because the government switched sides and they had to appoint someone to argue the opposite case, I think just coming in, the optics are going to be that all of the momentum is behind the side finding them to be inferior officers. However, they could be worried about the practical effects and look at this, and because there's not really a clear standard under the language or text of the Constitution, they could give pragmatic considerations a little more weight, in which case they'd say, we don't want to overturn the apple cart here, and we'll just let things go and try and draw distinctions with our prior cases. So as always, it's a little dangerous to make predictions, but that would be my prediction for this case.
Hey, thank you. But one more question, if I could. So
yeah.
I mean, if you could look at a cataclysmic effect, I mean, this could honestly, if they don't pull it back, and if they decide to make it retroactive, which I don't, they're not necessarily have to do that. But I mean, you could imagine, think of how many aliens have been removed or even, although it's not the same, in the criminal arena where they've gone ahead and found things unconstitutional, they said, we're going to start it now moving forward. So it seems to me like there may be some type of practical remedy built into whatever the ruling is when they end up deciding this case.
Absolutely.
Do you think it's going to be 9? I'm sorry to interrupt you, and you can finish off and I'll stop. What do you think the score is going to be at the end? I don't think it's going to be a 5-4. It's probably going to be a lot higher than that, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I think in this type of case, they probably want to speak with a more of a unified voice and come to what they feel is an approach people can get behind. So I would think it would be, 7-2 or higher or something like that. With regard to immigration judges, I don't remember. I maybe spoke a little hastily. I don't remember how exactly they're chosen, and that's really the key issue here. So if if under the laws for the immigration judges, they're appointed by someone who, you know, is in Congress, a court of law, or head of a department, or by the president, courts of law, or the heads of department, then they're totally fine, and in this case would not impact them. However, in a lot of agencies, ALJs are chosen through a bureaucratic method, such as SEC, where it's, you know, the staff that are choosing them based on a hiring process through OPM. So I don't remember specifically about immigration judges, so I'm not sure. But even if it doesn't include immigration judges, it really could call into question, you know, enforcement actions by, you know, all the major federal agencies potentially. And so the impact is really so large. They're more or less obligated to think about what it really means and figure out how to cabinet if necessary. But again, you know, they could decide that, you know, the mix of authorities here doesn't make the ALJs inferior officers, in which case, you know, it's not an issue. So the remedy question only comes up if they resolve the merits in favor of Lucia and the government. So,
hey, thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one question pending. Let's go to our next caller.
Yes. David Emerson with the Berkeley chapter of the Federal Society. Interesting situation. Question about the survival of the presidential value of some of the ALJ decisions and whether that was discussed, briefed, and considered, especially had to do with, you know, things that had to do with collateral estoppel, reliance on those decisions, res judicata, or even Chevron deference to those types of decisions in the district court, and whether or not the underlying issues would be susceptible to being disputed or reheard.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a question. I don't have a clear answer on that because I don't know. So that issue wasn't raised explicitly in the briefs that I saw, but I think it is definitely a real question. You know, the other, you know, Buckley v. Valeo, where they basically invalidated the current structure of the Federal Election Commission, there it was a fairly young agency, and so they didn't have, you know, a huge set of, you know, different types of precedents that, you know, had different types of impacts in different arenas. I would think, again, because of how disruptive it would be kind of to, you know, the operation of the SEC and, you know, the regulated community here, I would think they wouldn't write something that would say, you know, basically all of these acts have had zero binding value for the government, because it would just be so disruptive and difficult for everybody to just wipe away, you know, 80 years of regulation or, you know, of regulatory action. And so, again, like kind of similar to that case, they may ultimately say, well, they had de facto legitimacy at the time, and so they're going to be considered, you know, valid acts of the commission, even though going forward, you know, it has to be different. Otherwise, you know, they don't have authority to do what they're doing. So I think it's probably very unlikely that they would just wipe away everything that had been previously done in terms of, you know, its legal effect. But in terms of like individual adjudications, it's possible. So they could say, you know, every case that was before them, you know, you have to go back to those same people and retry them if you want to, you know, institute that fine or penalty. But I would think they wouldn't say, you know, basically every action can be totally ignored as if it didn't exist, but just because that would be so difficult. But, you know, who knows? If they want to take a strong principled stand here, they could conceivably do that.
Let me make a final call for questions. If you have a question, now's the time to ask it. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. I believe we've had our final question, Shane Kelly. So we've got some time left. Let me give you a minute or two to express a final thought if you have one.
Nothing different than I've already stated. Just I think it's a very interesting question, just because there's very little to hang your hat on in terms of trying to figure out what the outcome should be. It's possible, you know, they'll be looking at, you know, the historical context and the framers, but because the language is fairly broad, that may, you know, not really help much. And so I think it'll ultimately end up being, you know, what does the court want to do here and what do they want to do about it? And the answers to both those questions will have a lot of impact on the federal government. And it's just an interesting, you know, an abstract in some ways, but very interesting case to watch. And I look forward to seeing what they do.
Very good. Well, my thanks to you, Shane Kelly. Thank you for joining us. We will check back with you probably after this case is argued. Maybe there'll be some additional insights coming out of the oral argument. I want to thank the audience as well for joining us and for your thoughtful questions. I would tell you to watch your emails and check the website for the next scheduled Teleform conference call, but I happen to know that's at 2 p.m. today. So we'll begin that in just over an hour, 2 p.m. Eastern time, at this same number. We'll be talking about class versus U.S. That's a decision that came out of the Supreme Court, and it held a guilty plea does not bar a defendant from raising appeals based on constitutional grounds, and there was a strong dissent there. So an interesting result with an interesting dissent. We'll be talking about that at 2 p.m. Eastern time today. But until that next scheduled Teleform conference call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.